SCP-8007, the Pyroclasm Protocol. Dragons are one of the most pervasive elements of mythology across the globe, appearing in some form or another in practically every culture throughout history. Some have said that human fascination with the dragon stems from our innate fear of snakes and other dangerous reptiles, but the concept of a dragon in Western culture has become intimately tied to that of the fantasy genre. The common image of a European-style dragon is that of regal majesty rather than a slithering serpent, and dragons are often highlighted for their intelligence and greed. While they are often put into a villainous role due to them being a highly typical great beast meant to be slain, the fantasy genre has had plenty of examples of more heroic dragons. That brings us to SCP-8007, and if it's not obvious already, it's about dragons. It's very much in the fantasy genre, while still involving the typical trappings of the Foundation. Let's take a look. SCP-8007 is a draconic entity of indeterminate size within the caldera of Mount St. Helens. Through in-person examination and the use of specialized ground-penetrating radar, it has been found that the entity in part resembles depictions of European dragons, having six limbs, two of which being wings. While its length is presently unknown, its wingspan has been estimated to be roughly 3 kilometers at full extension. After its initial discovery in 1980, a Foundation-led expedition to study and uncover the remains further was conducted, with Dr. Helen Gibbs, geophysicist, as project lead, and Dr. Mary Naris, volcanologist and thaumatologist, as the lead field researcher. The team of 53 has been excavating and studying the entity for 2 months, and were provided a summary of their preliminary findings. They collected various minerals and rocks off of its body, with currently identified mineral samples including quartz, feldspar, pyroxene, hornblende, augite, and biotite mica. The mass of the entity is presently impossible to determine, and the mass of collected mineral samples has ranged greatly. A thaumaturgical ritual conducted by Dr. Naris to age-date the samples determined that they are consistent with native samples of Mount St. Helens that were unearthed by the recent eruption. These materials have crystallized on the outer portions of the entity, layered over top of each other in a manner similar to scales. The layer of crystallized materials is estimated to be several meters thick. Pegmatite quartz crystals cover the head of the anomaly and form a jagged crest. These crystalline structures cover portions of the jaw, snout, and back of the neck. All of these deposits dwarf the largest quartz crystal cluster that has previously been discovered on Earth. Along the back of the entity are 2 rows of 4 ridges. These massive dorsal ridges have been found to be completely hollow, and cracking in the rocks around their bases indicate that they were capable of some sort of movement. The ridges are similar in structure to stratovolcanoes, having their own miniaturized craters and lava chambers. The surface of the entity has been measured to be cooler than the surrounding geological structures of Mount St. Helens. The amount of deposited materials indicates that the entity was mostly sedentary, even when alive. Experimentation via Dr. Naris's thaumaturgical abilities and the size of the deposits upon the anomaly have led to the determination that it facilitates anomalously fast crystallization and mineral growth upon its body. Cracks and specific layering of rock indicate that it was capable of movement, but it's unclear what its range of motion was when alive. While attempting to harvest one of the pegmatite quartz, it was found that striking them resulted in resonation with the other crystals across the entity. This resonation caused a dramatic vibration across the entirety of the anomaly, enough to have knocked several personnel off their feet. It is theorized that with enough energy, kinetic or otherwise, even larger vibrations could be created. There are very few signs of what could have rendered the entity dead, but notes of its physical biology have been made. As of now, its chest has been fully excavated, and it's been found that the underside of the anomaly's chest is completely exposed and open, displaying the ribcage and entirely hollow interior. Its bones appear to be made of a currently undiscovered and naturally formed tungsten alloy. How this occurred is unknown, and has thus been deemed in part of the entity's anomalous nature. Within its chest, the partially hardened remains of a structure similar to a reptilian or avian heart have been uncovered. Solidified remains of artery-like structures indicate that the heart appeared to have been suspended within its chest. Parts of the heart were still incredibly high temperature and were partially molten. It's been determined that the heart's structure contains an incredibly high concentration of pure iron, mixed with an alloy similar to its bones. In spite of the fact that its mouth contains teeth, it has no apparent digestive system. While its external surface was notably cooler than the surroundings, some areas of its internals were hot enough to be considered hazardous to human health. The partially molten heart has placed its death as being within a similar time frame as Mount St. Helens eruption, which has led to the present theory that it was killed in the Plinian eruption. Research is ongoing. In a message from Dr. Naris to Dr. Gibbs, Naris says that she found something they're going to want to add to the report. While poking around in the internal cavity of the entity, she wanted to double-check her age dating, since the bones were geological too. She figured it'd be good to check her numbers, since maybe the minerals deposited on it were at a different time than the bones themselves. Or it just wore rocks, hermit crab style. She set up the ritual again and focused on the skeleton. This dragon is 3.8 billion years old. Gibbs just replies that she swears this thing gets weirder the more they look at it. That would put its existence being approximate to the Hadean period. She asks if they're sure it died recently, as for all they know, they're getting excited over something that died 3.7 billion years ago, and the eruption unearthed it. Sure, the heart was still partially molten, but so is the inside of the volcano they've been working on for the past several months. Naris replies that she's decently sure. Earlier today, they went further into the internal cavity, and they've started to find these holes, ranging from 5 to 10 meters in diameter. They've been drilled through parts of the carcass. She says drilled because they're perfectly circular and smooth. She doesn't think they're natural, and they found one on the back of the heart, too, cutting right through a part of it. Their original theory was that St. Helens eruption might have killed it, but she thinks they can reckon a guess that they found traces of something much different, having ended the beast. Gibbs asks if there are any traces of a culprit, such as tracks, marks, or anything that could indicate the presence of something alive. Or did someone get to this corpse before they did? Naris says that the best guess that can be made is another anomalous organism of some kind. She's not a biologist, but she'll look around the caldera a bit for any odd traces they might have missed on account of being a wee bit distracted by the entity. An extensive search of the St. Helens crater was conducted by the excavation team, discovering a number of things. There were abnormally high readings of thaumaturgical energy saturating the entirety of the caldera, with the highest concentration being around the entity itself. Despite these readings, no traces of any conducted thaumaturgical rituals were found, aside from the ones conducted by personnel. While magnetite is a known mineral within St. Helens, abnormally large fragments were discovered throughout the caldera. The largest of these fragments was 5 meters across, and while heavily damaged, appeared to be in a disc-like shape. It should be noted that magnetite does not naturally crystallize in this manner. The magnetite samples found within the caldera had thaumaturgical energy levels higher than their surroundings and displayed an anomalous attraction to iron. They found tunnels measuring roughly 10 meters, consistent with those found bored into the entity, throughout the internal structure of the stratovolcano. Lastly, the St. Helens lava chamber is completely devoid of magma, with such a phenomenon only having been seen in a singular other case, and the suddenness of this occurrence has been noted as out of the ordinary. Shortly after this discovery, St. Helens was deemed geologically extinct, and it's presently theorized that the entity's death may be related to this occurrence. Gibbs sends a message to Neris telling her that she needs to pack up the site, as she and the team are being transferred to Tolbachik in the Kamchatka Peninsula. Neris argues that they're still in the process of excavating 8007, and Tolbachik hasn't even had a single trace of activity since it blew 5 years ago. Gibbs just replies that that's exactly why she had it looked at, because St. Helens has gone dead too. They found another. On August 11th, 1980, a second deceased instance of SCP-8007 was discovered within the volcanic crater of the shield volcano Plavsky-Tolbachik in Russia. This instance was discovered when a reconnaissance team was sent by the geology department to do an aerial overview of the crater, which led to the spotting of its head and a portion of a front foot. Not sure how no one noticed that before. An excavation crew and other staff of the geology department were sent out to begin excavating the new instance. Biological and geological evaluation determined it to be physically similar to the instance within the Mount St. Helens caldera, albeit with a different composition of its outer coating. It's covered in crystallizations of primarily mafic minerals and rocks, such as basalt and various fumarole minerals. These findings are consistent with minerals exposed during the volcano's final eruption. Similarly to the first instance, it was found that the entity and the surrounding area contained a series of tunnels bored into the strata. This has been determined to be the instance's cause of death. Thaumaturgical energy readings of the area are similarly consistent with the previous discovery. A few weeks later, a third deceased entity was discovered following scans of other nearby volcanoes to examine their magma chambers. Their magma chambers were also found to be empty, but a third entity was found completely buried roughly 6 kilometers beneath Ostri-Tolbachik. The cause of this one's death is consistent with that of the previous two instances, as scans indicate the presence of tunnels that were also found in the other sites. Dr. Gibbs has put forward a project proposal for a full search of all volcanic systems along the Ring of Fire to locate any additional instances, dubbed Project Pyroclasm. We're given an abridged list of instances discovered by Project Pyroclasm. The sixth was found alive and uninjured in Mexico after a series of small tremors shook a volcano there. Fearing a sudden eruption, the investigating team fled the site and an alert was issued to the surrounding area. No eruption occurred, but the tremors went on for roughly 3 hours. The fracture point of these quakes was found to be the entity itself, a point along the back of its head. Due to previous observations of anomalous levels of resonance in deposited crystalline structures along the instance's backs, it has been concluded that instances of 8007 are capable of instigating earthquakes through these crystalline matrices. Instance 19 was found alive in Guatemala with a mild injury. It was discovered that the dorsal structures upon the entity's backs seem to have the purpose of storing magma, functioning akin to miniature stratovolcanoes. They appear to gradually fill with magma over time, and it's theorized that an eruption event is triggered once they reach maximum capacity. It's unknown to what degree of control, if any, they have over the causation of their eruptions. These chambers seem to fill at inconsistent rates, considering a lack of discernible pattern in previous eruptions along the Ring of Fire. It has also been noticed that instances of 8007 have a series of orifices along their necks, sides, and tails. On living instances, these function as vents that expel volcanic gases and water vapor. Instance 42 was found alive and uninjured underneath Mount Fuji in Japan. Investigation of the living instances has led to discovering the purpose of their molten iron hearts and arteries. It appears they use their hearts to pump magma up from the earth and through their bodies, consuming the thermal energy. This process not only accelerates the deposition of minerals upon the instances, but likely provides them with sustenance. The hearts also likely facilitate the forcing of magma up into their dorsal protrusions, catalyzing the resulting volcanic eruption once full. Instance 78 was found deceased in Indonesia, the fourth deceased instance discovered. Similar to the previous three, Scans have detected the presence of tunnels bored through the entity. These holes have been present on living instances as well, and the scanned amounts in comparison to those deceased are being utilized to determine the severity of injury. Causation is still unknown. It's noted that all of the deceased instances have partially ascended upwards in comparison to the living ones, indicating that instances have a final surge of action prior to death, despite their seemingly sedentary nature. It's theorized that the eruptions where the deceased instances were found were all the result of them releasing the remainder of their harvested thermal energy. Instance 221 was found alive in New Zealand, although scans of the surrounding volcanic environment indicated odd and unnatural structures in proximity to it. While these structures are currently unreachable, they seem to have been created or carved by the instance. Scans indicate that they resemble pillars, with carvings too small to be accurately picked up by ground-penetrating radar. In light of this discovery, the intelligence level of 8007 is being reconsidered. Instance 443 was found alive, albeit severely injured, underneath Krakatoa in Indonesia. Due to the existence of only one instance within the Krakatoa archipelago, in spite of the previous presence of four volcanoes, the discovery of the 443rd instance confirms that singular instances can be responsible for the activity of more than one volcano. Consistent with all previous findings, the volcanic area reflects the size of the instance, and instance 443 is measured to be roughly 15 kilometers in length. It's noted that in comparison to other discovered instances, this is considered small. Throughout Project Pyroclasm, several volcanic structures outside of the geological area of the Ring of Fire were searched to determine if the 8007 phenomenon is unique to the specific geological location or widespread across Earth. Number 447 was the final instance discovered, and is the only 8007 instance not directly on the Ring of Fire, instead lying adjacent to the center of the ring within Mauna Loa in Hawaii. Due to Mauna Loa being the largest active volcano on Earth, and the fact that this instance's location is an outlier, it was deemed a location of interest. Additionally, scans have indicated that this instance is the first truly accessible one, through a series of tunnels within the volcano leading directly to the magma chamber. After this discovery, a small team was dispatched to descend into Mauna Loa's magma chamber, led by Dr. Gibbs, along with Dr. Naris, Dr. Lindsay, geophysicist, and Dr. Weller, field geologist and former MTF captain. Dr. Weller asks if they're going to be okay in there, to which Dr. Lindsay says, of course, as they have protective suits and some small stone charms from Site 120 that will make them practically fireproof as long as they're on their person. Dr. Gibbs, functioning remotely as command, tells them to prepare to descend, and Dr. Lindsay leads the way. The three-person team enters the magma tube and begins walking. Lindsay asks Naris if they think this instance accounts for the eruption of Kilauea as well, to which she says most likely. Dr. Weller asks what do they do if this turns nasty, since the things they have are likely to be a gnat to something like this thing. Naris just says that they run like hell, as there's nothing else they really can do. Lindsay remarks that as long as they don't annoy the several kilometer long dragon, they'll be fine. Besides, they don't even seem to move much. Weller replies that they don't know that for sure, but Naris says that over the past 5 years, they've observed them spending the majority of the time just dormant and pumping lava through themselves. They probably only awaken for eruptions, or if hurt, and she hopes that it's awake so they can see something that huge in motion. Weller isn't too convinced, but he comments on how wonderful the rock here is, as his department has been having a field day with the excavation of the deceased instances. Naris says that she's not entirely in favor of mining the corpses, as some folks have suggested, but these dragons and how fast they gain deposits could revolutionize their methods of study. Dr. Weller says that their main concern should lie in what's killing them at the moment, and asks if they think this one will be injured as well. Dr. Lindsay says that the scan suggested some light injury, and she pulls out a metallic object about the size of a baseball. It's an orb of neodymium, as they think that whatever has been hurting the dragons keeps leaving bits of magnetite. If there's any traces, they'll find them. The team descends deeper into Mauna Loa, and the temperature of the surrounding air begins to sharply increase. After approximately 50 minutes of downward travel, Dr. Naris expresses pain, stating that the thaumaturgical energy levels must have skyrocketed. The place is positively drenched in them, giving her a headache and a half. Dr. Weller takes that to mean that they're getting close, and the team keeps moving. It takes them over an hour to reach their destination, and the temperature in the air reaches roughly 1,000 degrees Celsius, but their protective gear remains intact. They enter into a massive chamber, about 250 meters above a pit of magma. It extends for several hundred meters before a wall of mafic rock intersects it. Dr. Lindsay looks around and gasps, noting the presence of pillars carved into the wall, many meters thick and rising upwards. They are of the same basalt as the cavern, with twisting and winding patterning across them. The cavern is too dark to see that far up the wall. Dr. Naris, meanwhile, turns her attention to what lies beyond, noting that this should be an open chamber. Dr. Lindsay says that she thinks it is, and all members of the team cover their eyes as a bright orange light suddenly appears, far brighter than the magma. Its source is a singular eye, with estimates putting it at 53 meters in diameter. 8007-447 shifts its head to face the group, and now the full extent of the cavern can be seen. Dr. Weller swears and remarks that he can't even see the other side, as it's all just gas and fog. An upper portion of the dragon's wing can be seen far off in the distance, pressed up against the roof of the cavern. Its back and dorsal protrusions are mountain-like, bisecting the cavern and cutting through the ceiling. Its head is covered in dark black stones, and pieces of volcanic glass crown its head in a series of twisting, curved horns. Its snout ends in a sharp, jagged point of obsidian. Dr. Lindsay is amazed at the obsidian, but Dr. Naris isn't well, stating again how steeped this place is in thaumaturgical energy. She's never felt a concentration like this before, but maybe it's just inexperience with places like this. The temperature around the team briefly surges when the dragon exhales in a loud huff, and Dr. Naris crumples as she hears a voice stating, "A raging fire, brilliant and bright, a shove, curiosity, burning." Dr. Lindsay and Weller rush to her, and she groans and sits up with their aid. Blood can be seen trailing down from her nose. The dragon has noticeably pulled back. Naris swears and wheezes for approximately 30 seconds. She remarks that she thinks it tried to communicate with her, with images and feelings, not words. It was strong, though, and loud, and she hears it again, saying, "A female songbird raises her head and sings. It is low, somber." Naris stares back up at the dragon, furrowing her brow as Lindsay helps her back to her feet. The team is glad to hear that the entities are sentient, and Naris asks Gibbs for permission to continue communication, which is granted. Naris believes that its communication is limited to thaumaturgy, which makes sense due to scans indicating that they're the source of the high amounts of thaumaturgical energy. Naris asks it what it is, and it lets out a low, vibrating rumble as she hears it say, "Magma, a cavern far below, fire, bubbling heat." She mutters that it's going to be difficult to parse this. She surmises that they are those below the flames. Lindsay asks it if it has a name, and it responds with, "A mountain being hounded by waves, but it doesn't shake nor crumble. A mother dragon protects her hatchling, surrounded by a blazing forest that burns despite the rain. Neris ponders on this for a moment before surmising that she thinks she's called Standing Ceaseless, Protection of Everlasting Fire, which sounds like something out of Spirit Island if I can make my nerd reference of the day. The rest of the team introduces themselves as the dragon bobs her head, seemingly in return for their greetings. Lindsay then notices something on the wall behind them and tells the others to take a look. They see now that the wall behind them is covered in massive, intricate carvings. Directly above the tunnel's entrance is the carving of three massive dragons, resembling SCP-8007 instances. They sit upon sharp rocks and flowing lines that appear to indicate lava and fire. The middle one has horns similar to Everlasting Fire, and above them are carvings of smaller instances, flying through smoky air. Neris asks Everlasting Fire if it carved them, to which it says, "Claws scraping stone. A black dragon with twisted horns, far smaller, sits in a massive cavern. Her molten claw burns shapes into the walls. Spiraling black horns crown her head." Neris compliments it on its handiwork, as Gibbs asks if she can determine its meaning. Lindsay points out that there's more on another wall, showing a massive creature, almost scribbly carved, with many limbs and teeth, burning a massive fire. The entity is shown destroying mountains and attacking the dragons, as the dragons breathe fire at this mass of teeth and claws, while others drop mountains on it. The massive entity is buried beneath the earth, with smoke and fire rising. Several dragons stand in a circle, with the one resembling Everlasting Fire seeming to lead them. The next carving shows several dragons going underground, and the entity is seen with its claws reaching upwards, still buried. The fire that surrounds it is carved connecting to the dragons. The fire around the entity weakens, and its eyes close. Everlasting Fire growls as the team discusses the carvings, making all of them jump. It says, "Clawing, screeching, earthquakes, volcanoes erupt, dragons crushed under rock and lava. A creature of indistinct form, cloaked in fire, destroying all in its path." Neris grimaces deeply and shivers despite the heat. She notes that the dragons look tiny in the carvings compared to the entity, while Lindsay remarks that the environment depicted in the carvings makes the earth look molten. Weller says that if they're talking about the Hadean period, they don't even have geological records of that time frame. Since that lines up with the dating of the bones, that makes them billions of years old. Neris asks Gibbs to run a scan on the tectonic plates, thermal readings for the Pacific tectonic plate and the Ring of Fire, aiming deep. Gibbs replies that that's a massive region to analyze, so Neris tells her to pull from the seismic stations along the coast to triangulate the data. The team discusses the fact that this is almost certainly related to the fact that they've been finding injured and dead dragons, and the one leading them all looks to be Everlasting Fire. The dragon speaks again, stating, "Raging fire, rock and molten earth oozing over dark stone, the ground trembling, claws tearing through the dirt, far, far below, wings, a shield. Protect, protect, protect. A mountain being pounded by waves of molten lava." Neris says that the dragons did all this to protect, but Lindsay asks why, as it seems like whatever they buried has stayed that way for a long time. The dragon growls and says, "Inferno. Pressure forcing up. Choking. Cracking. Beating hearts of fire. Magma drawn up from deep below. Drain. Drain. Weaken. Fire fades. Pressure releases." Neris wheezes and leans against the wall, squeezing her eyes shut. She thinks that the dragons are the reason that thing is still down there, like they're draining it. All the seismic and volcanic activity comes from the dragons eating that thing's energy, and now they're dying. The team sits in silence for a few minutes, until Gibbs tells them that they found the biggest concentration of thermal energy and pressure she's seen in her life, right below the tectonic plate. There's something underneath. If their projections are correct, this thing is spread out underneath the entire Pacific Ocean, right in the mantle. She ran the same check on a dataset from about 2 decades ago, and while there's still clearly something there, the pressure buildup is nowhere near as bad. Neris turns to the dragon and asks if it's been hurt, if it knows what's even causing this. There's another series of tremors, and the dragon makes a low sound, a mix between a growl and a whine. Then it roars, a crackling sound like an avalanche. When it rears back, a hole dripping molten magma can be seen on a lower portion of its neck. It states, "Holes torn through scales. Magma runs like blood. Heartache. Vultures tear at a lizard's corpse. A hawk wasp's larva devours the paralyzed tarantula." Neris yells and clutches her head as the tremors begin to increase in intensity. They yell to each other, and Lindsay's eyes widen as she pulls the neodymium magnet out of her bag. Part of the rock wall a few meters from the group starts to crumble, and the dragon screeches like metal on metal. It states, "A wolf howls warning," and Neris yells for the others to get down. A portion of wall crumbles before exploding outwards. The entity that bursts into the cavern appears to resemble a snake made of pure fire, but instead of having a head, it has a 3.5 meter wide disc of metal. Neris and Lindsay narrowly avoid being hit by the rubble when it emerges, screeching. Weller takes the rifle from his back as the serpent lunges in Lindsay's direction. Weller opens fire, but the bullets simply strike through the fire without harm, and it merely hisses. Its focus stays on Lindsay, and she scoots backwards as it snarls. Neris recognizes the metal disc from St. Helens. They found a fragment like that was a weird form of magnetite. She shouts at Lindsay that it's after the neodymium, as Weller shoots again, this time at the metal disc. The bullets clang off the metal, leaving dents, and the entity rears back with a screech. Lindsay hurls the neodymium away, and the serpent's head whips over towards it. It lunges, slamming into the ground and burrowing down, leaving half of the neodymium melted and shattered in the process. Neris yells to ask if it's leaving, but Lindsay doesn't think so, as there's too much magnetic stuff in this cave. She gestures wildly towards the dragon, exclaiming that their hearts are made of iron. The tremors return, and the dragon appears agitated. Gibbs asks if any of them are hurt. Lindsay says that they're fine for now, but if that thing punctures their suits, she doesn't know how much saving them the extra wards will be doing. The tremors grow more intense, and Weller asks how in the hell they take this thing out. Lindsay just yells that he's the one with MTF training. Weller asks Neris if her thaumaturgy can be weaponized, but she has no idea, suggesting that she might be able to throw a rock. Weller tells her to start throwing rocks then. The serpent bursts back out from the hole it made, its attention now directed towards the dragon. Weller begins opening fire on the disc, which appears to disorient the entity. Neris attempts to use her thaumaturgy to send some of the earlier debris at it, but she misses. The serpent screeches and attempts to fling itself at the dragon, which roars and slices at the rocky ceiling, sending a spray of dirt and rock down at it. The entity's flames waver, and the creature screams as though harmed before it swiftly slithers away. Lindsay just narrowly dodges being hit by a hunk of stone herself, and the dragon reels back with a low sound. Neris shouts that they have to suffocate the fire, and Weller replies that if they buy him some time, he can set up a charge to cause a bigger collapse. Lindsay runs over and grabs the half-melted neodymium, waving it towards the serpent and shouting. The creature snarls and turns towards her, as Weller sets up a detonation charge against the wall. Neris grabs a fallen chunk of rock and throws it at the entity as it approaches Lindsay. It phases through the creature's tail and makes the flames swirl. It hisses loudly and shakes out its head, pivoting to look between Lindsay and Neris. Weller finishes and shouts for them to get it over towards the wall. Lindsay draws its attention and yells for it to fetch, throwing the neodymium towards the wall. It hisses and lunges towards it as Weller detonates the charge, sending a series of cracks up the wall before a myriad of rubble comes down on top of the serpent. It screeches, a sound like crackling fire, as rocks and dust pour onto it. Its fires weaken as more falls and the wall partially collapses, and its metal disc clatters to the ground. There is a pause of silence as they catch their breath, and Weller states that he's honestly surprised that worked. That thing burrowed all the way here from somewhere, so he wouldn't have thought it would be so fragile. Neris believes that the disc functioned like a shield, allowing it to burrow. She and Lindsay approach it, with Lindsay noting that it's definitely magnetite, and she tells Weller to tap it with his rifle. The muzzle sticks to the disc, resisting being pulled away. This is what's been killing the dragons, and judging by how many injured and dead there are probably a whole lot of these serpents. Neris notes that this thing must have been some sort of elemental construct, with the disc being the anchor. The dragon makes a low rumbling sound and says, "Clawing, teeth, burning fire below, a mother spider crawling with her offspring, metal discs carved with a thousand wicked claws, scorched earth, coyotes circle a crying baby." Neris interprets to the others that it seems that the entity that the dragons imprison below the earth is responsible. It's retaliating against its captors, quite effectively, as these things are too small for the dragons to properly deal with. Neris states that they have to help the dragons, and Gibbs asks what exactly she's suggesting. The dragon then roars, shaking the cavern, and says, "An ash-filled sky, a boiling ocean, a burning world, a molten beast of fire screaming to the heavens as its emergence levels all in its path. Pyroclastic flows. Cataclysm." Neris says that she's suggesting they devise a way to deal with this, with the constructs at least, or they're screwed. If more die, then the continent-sized monster they're keeping imprisoned gets out. With how big it is, and how much it's built up, there's no way anything survives an event like that. Weller says that they're suggesting some serious action on the Foundation's part, and asks what would they even do. The Ring of Fire is an absolutely massive area to monitor, and there are over 400 instances. Gibbs tells the team to head back, as she'll bring this issue to higher-ups. As the team returns to their feet, the dragon stares at them, now silent. Lindsay tells it that they're departing now, but they're going to help. They're not about to watch the world burn. The dragon makes a low noise, a vibration almost similar to a purr. It says, "A dragon curls around a fragile bird. The crackling of a small, gentle fire. Warmth." Neris just smiles and says that she likes that. The team was able to return without issue, and Dr. Gibbs called for a conference with the Department of Geology to discuss and plan further action. She eventually sent a message to the O5s about a proposal to reclassify SCP-8007, and were given a new document for 8007 behind Level 5 clearance. SCP-8007 now refers to the source of the Ring of Fire geological phenomena via instances designated 8007-1 to 447. These instances are sapient draconic entities that have adapted to live within the chambers of the active volcanoes along the Ring of Fire, responsible for all geological activity along the subduction zones of the Pacific tectonic plate and surrounding tectonics. They feed off of a newly discovered anomalous generation of intense thermal energy that is being produced underneath the Pacific tectonic plate, believed to be created by a secondary entity. Analysis of the area has indicated that this entity possesses an indeterminate number of entangled limbs and heads, displaying a form of radial symmetry. The entity spans underneath the entirety of the Pacific tectonic plate, roughly 410 kilometers below the surface. The dragons have been operating under a self-imposed duty of ensuring that the entity remains contained underneath the Pacific tectonic plate for an estimated 3.8 billion years. This is done via the draining, consumption, and excess venting of the entity's energy output in the form of geological activity. It's believed that if the dragons were to fail in the draining/venting of this energy, the resulting buildup would result in the detonation of the Pacific tectonic plate and lead to a WK-class mass extinction event, alternatively classified as a WK-class rain of fire scenario. The entity also is responsible for thaumaturgical constructs resembling serpents made of fire. The only physical part of these constructs are a circular disc of magnetite, ranging from 5 to 10 meters in diameter, that make up their heads. They utilize these discs to seek out and attack the dragons via magnetism, specifically the iron-rich hearts and arteries. The discovery that the dragons were being killed due to retaliation by the entity via the constructs and the threat this posed has since resulted in the creation of the Foundation's Pyroclasm Protocol. The Pyroclasm Protocol is a two-part Foundation-mandated action taken in joint with those below the flames to ensure the prevention of a rain of fire scenario. Part 1 involves the construction and maintenance of 5 outposts, with joint command from the Geology Department and Site 120. They are built within the hollow remains of the deceased instances within Mount St. Helens, Plosky Tolbachik, Ostry Tolbachik, Mount Agung, and Galeras. The area designated Sector A of these sites holds a central reactor that consists of the reactivated heart of the deceased instance. The heart is encapsulated within a series of tungsten walls, the material harvested from the dragon's bones, suspended within the magma chamber that formed upon the heart's revival. Piping has been constructed around the original suspension arteries of the heart, and are used to pipe magma to the primary chamber. The circular platform, roughly 100 meters in diameter, located above the central reactor heart, is to be utilized for access to the heart through a central hole. It also provides access to artery piping and other sectors of the site. This central platform is secured to the instance's rib cage through welded suspension cables and several constructed support pillars. The primary chamber is located at Sector B, within the upper chest of the instance. The artery pipes run upwards and into the back protrusions in order to supply them with magma. To slow the process of filling the protrusions, the primary chamber contains 6 holding tanks connected to the artery pipes. Utilizing the instance's side vents, volcanic gas and water vapor from within the holding tanks is forced through a series of turbines constructed inside. The energy harvested from this process is to be used to power the site and its backup generator. Excess power is rerouted to other Foundation facilities. Sector C contains staff housing for roughly 300 individuals, as well as cafeterias and 3 small research sectors. Bi-monthly shipments of living supplies are to be distributed to the sites containing both necessities and occasional amenities upon request. Sector C also contains the evacuation site and eruption event shelters. Staffing of these sites is to chiefly be done by the Geology Department, including maintenance staff, technicians, and janitorial. Transferring of staff from other sites to fill gaps may occur. 4 thaumaturgical ritual circles are specifically constructed in the following locations: the central reactor heart, primary chamber, research sector 1, and sector D. These sites are to be used to maintain the heat protective wards, utilized in the protection of staff and the site's structures from extreme heat and toxic gases. The everlasting ritual is utilized for the revitalizing of an instance's heart, and requires the following. The solid heart is to be uncovered, and remain suspended in the air by its arteries. In the area below the heart, a tunnel of any width is to be dug into the volcano's magma chamber. 4 sulfur idols, carved like a dragon's fang, are to be placed around the heart in the 4 cardinal directions. An ultramafic rock sample is to be crushed into powder, and this powder is to be poured in a way that connects all 4 idols. Carved inscriptions of the name of the corresponding deceased instance need to be present, and a lifeblood tear of everlasting flame is to be poured onto the heart. Once all this is undergone, a surge of fire-based thaumaturgical energy is required to jumpstart the ritual. Transferred mages from Site 120 are to maintain protective wards daily, and renew the everlasting ritual on a bi-weekly basis at the central reactor heart via replacement of the sulfur idols and ultramafic dust. In the event that a reactor fully shuts down and leaves its molten state, the original reactivation ritual is to be undergone as soon as possible. Levels of thermal energy and magma within the dorsal structures are to be monitored, and early warnings are to be distributed to the areas surrounding the sites at least 1 to 2 days prior to the execution of a Foundation-controlled volcanic eruption. Activation of an eruption event must be approved by Site Command. During an eruption event, the site is to undergo lockdown. All individuals on site are to shelter in Sector D for the duration of the eruption to ensure safety of staff. To summarize all that, the Foundation has built facilities inside of some dead dragons underneath volcanoes, encapsulating their dead hearts in walls made from their bones, and restarting them through a bi-weekly thaumaturgical ritual. It's probably not even the most ridiculous thing they did that week. Additionally, a series of small-scale, unmanned outposts have been constructed along locations in the Ring of Fire, utilizing a highly compressed and concentrated iron core buried just below them. These cores function as lures for instances of the serpentine entities, and as a disposal for them. When one enters the chamber, their heat signatures will cause the thaumaturgical wards within to activate, at which point all oxygen within the space will be removed. The sudden removal of all fuel will immediately terminate the instance. These wards only require yearly renewal to ensure their function, and for the removal of the metal disks, which are to be melted down and utilized elsewhere. SCP-8007-1, Everlasting Fire, is to be deferred to yearly on the status of the entity under the Earth and the condition of all other dragons to ensure protective measures have remained successful. This is to be done through Dr. Naris and O5-5. We're then given a recording of a return to Mount Mauna Loa in order to establish communication with Everlasting Fire about the Foundation's intentions and acquirement of thaumaturgical aid. To demonstrate goodwill and a desire to hold true to the promise of aid, Dr. Gibbs, Dr. Naris, O5-4, and O5-5 partake in the creation of a ritualistic pact with Everlasting Fire as part of the Pyroclasm Protocol. Gibbs and Naris stand at the entrance to the Mauna Loa tunnel in fire proximity suits. Gibbs remarks that she can't tell if she's more worried about the 100-kilometer-long dragon or the 205s. Naris replies that she can at least vouch that the dragon is quite nice. The sounds of a helicopter grow audible, and when it touches down, 2 individuals exit. Gibbs greets them, and Naris asks if she bows, as she's not entirely on track with etiquette since she looks at rocks all day. Gibbs grimaces, but O5-4 gives an amused smile and says, "Dear no," as that's a tad archaic. O5-5 greets them, stating that their department has done impressive work with pyroclasm. O5-4 puts on a fire proximity suit and protective wards, while O5-5 remains deliberately dressed in what she arrived in. The group heads down the tunnel, and O5-4 reminds Naris that she is to repeat everything the anomaly tells her. 055 asks her how it communicates, and Neris guesses it to be some form of very rudimentary telepathy, since it only communicates with thaumaturges. 055 asks the dragon's name, and Neris says that it's damn hard to determine exacts when you're getting images and emotions shoved into your brain. 054 calls it fascinating, remarking on it being such a long name, and refers to the dragon as a she, an extremely rare example of an 05 referring to an anomaly as something other than an it. 054 asks if it's been considered that the other dragons are possibly named in a similar fashion, and says that they could ask Everlasting Fire the names of the fallen when the opportunity arises, out of respect. The team travels for 2 hours underneath the volcano, with 054 occasionally asking further questions pertaining to SCP-8007. 055 remains silent, but on a few occasions raises a hand to brush the wall of the corridors. They emerge into the large chamber, appearing in the same state as it was previously. When the group makes themselves known, Everlasting Fire raises her head up out of the magma, causing fiery light to glitter along the obsidian that forms her horns and the surrounding deposits. 054 turns in a tight circle, going from the dragon to the carvings, then back to the dragon, and chuckles. He remarks that the report doesn't do it justice. Neris approaches the edge of the outcropping, and 055 walks next to her. The two stare up at the dragon, looming above them. A rumble shakes the cave. Neris jumps, and 055 reaches a hand to her temple. It greeted them, and Neris chuckles, saying that it's good to see she's gotten a better hand on volume. The four bow, and 054 states that it is of great honor to stand here before her. Neris says that the dragon wants to know why he's here. The two 05s introduce themselves as two of the 12 leaders of the Foundation. They were brought here to discuss aiding her and her kind. Everlasting Fire shakes out her head, and a high noise like a trill echoes from its maw. Neris translates it as hope and excitement. 054 states that they've devised a plan to help, but they've come to receive her blessing on it, to form a pact with her. They know of a way to keep away the constructs that have been harming her and the rest of her kind. Presently, an order of construction is being undergone. If it works, they will no longer harm them. However, there is a main reason they have come to speak with her. They seek her permission to revitalize the hearts of the five dragons who have fallen, so that the Foundation can carry out their duties for them, post-mortem. A low growl echoes from the dragon's mouth, and the circle of horns around her head flare outwards. Neris quickly says that their bodies won't be destroyed. They will respect them, and their hearts will remain where they are. This seems to placate the dragon, as the fires flicker out. 055 asks if she can tell them the names of her fallen comrades. The dragon blinks long and slow, and her jaws parked in a high trill, stating their names to be Endless Eons, Billowing Smoke, in St. Helens. Wings of Fire, Flying Far Away, in Ploski Tolbache. Erupt to the Horizon, Cavern of Teeth, in Ostri Tolbache. Ashen Sky, Fall of Glowing Embers, in Agung. And Distant Roar, Bones of Stone, in Galeris. 055 nods and says that they'll honor their names. The dragon brings her head back close to the outcropping and lets out a chittering sound. Neris translates it as curiosity, asking if they want anything in return for their aid. 055 says that they have one request. The ritual is missing a vital component. To revive the hearts, they need something of a living ilk. There is a long pause before it speaks again, which Neris interprets to mean blood. 055 nods again and says lifeblood, if she's willing. 054 asks if they have the means to carry something like that, prompting Gibbs to ask Neris if she has the energy for some light geomancy. Neris steps away and crouches down to the ground. The rock between her hands begins to bend and morph into something resembling a large jug or jar. 054 takes the jar and moves to the edge of the outcropping, hoisting the jar upwards. Everlasting Fire brings her eye close to the group, and from its corner, a glowing orange light begins to condense. Like a tear, this droplet of fire falls from the eye, and 054 catches it within the jug. The substance within is a brilliant orange, with swirling motes of white and yellow and red within. Some flake off like embers, dancing in the air, and the globe pulses like a heartbeat. 055 thanks her, truly, and Gibbs asks if that means they're ready for the pact. Utilizing a set of thin blades, 055 and Neris begin carving a series of interconnected circles and sharp lines into the rocky ground. The large ritual site's construction takes roughly 30 minutes, during which Gibbs engages 054 in a discussion on the local geology, with Neris occasionally chiming in. Everlasting Fire watches, her heartbeat causing a subtle tremor in the room each time it beats. The finished ritual circle's design holds four triangular shapes jutting from cardinal directions, appearing like jagged rocks pointing inwards, with five overlapping circles along the center. Runic inscriptions line the sides of those circles. Neris turns to face Everlasting Fire and says that it is ready. She lets out a deep, reverberating rumble. Neris interprets it as a loved one's warmth, the entity underneath the earth, a dragon with wings spread and a smaller one behind it. 055 chuckles faintly and believes it to mean secure, contain, and protect. The dragon rumbles again, and the very tip of the obsidian horn at the end of her snout pierces the rock at the center of the ritual circle. 055 gestures for the others to come closer, and all four kneel down, placing a hand on each of the carved triangles. 055's eyes light with a fiery glow. An orange light from her fingers begins to leak and flow into the sigils, curling up the arms of the others in swirls and dancing patterns across the dragon's snout. The dragon rumbles, a sound that vibrates the very stone that surrounds them all, and the massive carvings and pillars begin to light up and pulse with a similar glow. The dragons carved on the walls almost seem to move with the way that the shadows and firelight dances. At a small signal given by 055, all four individuals stand, and each extend their right hand outwards. There is a moment of silence as they close their eyes. The dragon breaks the silence with a low purr, and she gently moves her head so that the hands make contact with her snout. The sigils below them burn brighter, pulsing once, and then twice. At the ritual's completion, the dragon raises her head back and away. The glowing marks on 055's arm remains, along with the marks on the other three and the dragon. 055 states that the pact has been sealed. The Foundation shall maintain their part in aiding in the dragon's ancient duty for as long as they stand. She shall not stand ceaseless alone. The dragon rumbles, low and deep and long, and her massive back spines grind against each other. Neris laughs and says that this is what pride and joy feels like. 055 smiles and adds in hope. The dragon's jaw parts and she lets out a roar. It sounds like an explosion and it shakes the cavern. In the distance, the foggy form of one of her front limbs emerges from the magma and grips the wall. The dragon suddenly surges upwards, ascending at a startling speed. The whole cavern begins to shake, along with Mauna Loa. 055's eyes widen, and she yells for the others to get close. She quickly performs a teleportation spell, removing all four of them from the cavern. The surface location they reappear at is roughly a kilometer away from their initial entry point. Everlasting Fire bursts from the crater of Mauna Loa and raises her head to the sky. She is silhouetted by billowing smoke and crackling volcanic lightning, the fire from her jaws and chest creating a glowing halo around her form. Later reports of her roar, the sound of the eruption, would be heard almost halfway around the globe. and the ring of fire roars back. So, to recap, billions of years ago, there were a bunch of dragons flying around and living their lives. Then some horrible fire monster showed up and ruined their day, so they fought back and imprisoned it deep underneath the surface. Since it wasn't dead, it continued to generate massive amounts of thermal energy, which would build up enough pressure eventually to basically destroy the world, or at least all life on it. The dragons gathered around in a massive circle above where this entity resided, and built up large accumulations of minerals around them, forming volcanoes. They all sat there for billions of years, sucking up this thermal energy and occasionally releasing it in the form of eruptions in order to prevent the massive explosion. Unfortunately, the entity has finally grown wise to this and started sending out elemental constructs armed with big metal detectors to head up, find the iron hearts of the dragons, and bore holes through them until they die. With multiple dragons now dead or injured, the entity was on a path towards release. Fortunately, this happened to occur during a brief time when humans were on the planet and were able to do something like make advanced facilities inside of dragon corpses and perform complex thaumaturgical rituals to reanimate the dragon hearts. This allows the Foundation to replicate the process the dragons use, re-establishing the Ring of Fire protection zone and preventing a Rain of Fire scenario. No bald Matthew McConaughey's with an axe for us. It's definitely a very fantastical, feel-good story, and doesn't really ever try to hide that fact. There's no grim, dour O5s that tell others the unfortunate truth. There's no cold, calculating Foundation. There's no sad ending for the dragons. At the same time, I can't really say the actions here are entirely out of character for the Foundation, aside from perhaps some somewhat uncommon behavior for a couple of O5s. The Foundation is not above using anomalies to help contain other anomalies, hence the whole Thaumiel object class. And aside from the ending where Everlasting Fire briefly popped out, the dragons are pretty content to just sit there and avoid the public eye. It's just kind of a rare SCP article where things just sort of work out for everyone involved. Except for the ancient entity imprisoned beneath the earth, I suppose. Sure, it's not going to be everyone's cup of tea, but dragons are cool. Volcanoes are cool, and volcanic dragons are really cool.